Well, now it's time for that special part. The couple you're going to hear tonight, remember I said couple, is the reason that all of us are sitting in these chairs tonight. I don't know how you guys want to do it first, but they came all the way from Havasu?
Yeah.
Okay.
This time?
Okay. The other time you're up in Beaver?
Beaver, Utah.
Oh, okay. So I show you how much they love us. They showed up for our anniversary. And like I said, this would not be a meeting if it don't be for Patty and Candy, so I don't want to take any more of their time. Patty and I, I don't know who else was here now that was here at that first meeting. But as you see, it's perpetual. It keeps going. And when they throw the dirt on the two of us, it'll keep going. So now I want to introduce my dear friends, Patty and Candy. Well, she can come.
Hi everyone, I'm Candy and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm sad tonight, I missed you all so much. Didn't think I'd get emotional this quick. How much time?
We're going to be here until...
Because I don't want to take 1 minute of his time. Okay, you help me figure it out.
8 o'clock.
All right, I was sitting here thinking, I don't even know why I'm up here tonight. I know why I'm here, because of my alcoholism, but when Jack called Pat about this commitment tonight, Pat said graciously no, because we had to be here Sunday. We got here Sunday for a committee meeting down in Long Beach or some beach town. And Pat thought, we can't go back and come back and everything. And I said, call Jack back. You need to, you know. You don't turn down an Al-Anon request. And so I called back, and it was all arranged. And then when the flyer came out, my name was on it, too. It's like, oh, I got me in trouble. But John, wherever you are, that flyer was just fabulous. Thank you. And to share a little bit of my Al-Anon tendencies, Pat will probably tell you that I'm the reason this particular meeting started. Because he whined and complained and whined and complained for the longest time that there were no men stag meetings around, and I said, go start one. And he did, and he did what a good Al-Anon would do. He picked the night he wanted, the time of the night, and everything else. But then I kind of helped him, you know, they're reading this, and it's like, when the secretary was reading the format, it's like, I know that as well as how it works that we read in every AA meeting, because I was there helping him put it together, and we read it and read it and read it, and it's still there. It's really neat. It's amazing to me that this has been going for 22 years, and I'm so proud of all of you men that are still here. And I told Betty I was sad, because I can remember coming to this every single month. I would say, this is my once a month home Al-Anon meeting, because I would come every month for this, whatever you call it, the person, the speaker meeting. And I got a little bit of your Al-Anon recovery, just a little bit. I'm a pure alcoholic. I grew up in an alcoholic home, but I didn't know it. My father passed away when I was 12 years old from alcoholism. He fell asleep with a belly full of beer and a cigarette in his hand, and he burnt the building down. They called it an accidental fire death, and that's what it was in those years. You know, we didn't. But what I remember specifically was I was brought home from school from my grandmother. The kids on the playground told me what happened, that it was my daddy that had fallen asleep and burnt that building down. And so I remember the principal took me into the office and sat me down, and then my grandmother came and picked me up that day. She'd never done that. I didn't have any, you know, close connection with my grandmother so much, and that was strange to me. And I got home that night, and nobody talked about it. And that's kind of how it was in my family as a child when I was growing up. And I can remember one of the first times that Pat and I were speaking. It was down towards Laguna somewhere, and my mom lived there at that time, and We went down and we got dressed. We went and visited her for the day and we got dressed and we were going out and we were going to speak. And she said, well, what do you tell them? And I said, well, we tell them what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And she said, well, you don't tell them everything, do you? And that's just a, you know, that's just kind of how I grew up. So lots of secrets. And I met Pat at 14. I called him my boyfriend. We really weren't that yet, but I called him that. And we dated in and out of high school, off and on. But I remember in the early days of our dating that he would tell me when to be at the locker and if I were to be at his locker that day. And I always did whatever he said. And I also remember, like, my first seeing him was when I asked him to fix my skateboard. It was broken. And he fixed it, and I liked those kinds of things, and I always did what he said. I liked that. I liked him being in charge. I don't know why, but I did. And so when it was time to graduate from high school, and like I say, we dated in high school on and off, and I dated that football player and the president of the class, and then that football player, and then back to the other guy. And it was time to graduate, and he was going to get this football scholarship at the Arizona State University. So I quickly applied, and I got accepted, and I went off to ASU. There you see the pattern. Well, he changed his mind at the last minute. I'm over at ASU. And I stayed there for 2 years, and then he was up at San Jose on a football scholarship. So I left in the summer before my junior year, went up to San Jose. And the very first play of the very first football game, he got injured, lost the scholarship, but he got picked up. And he got a scholarship for 3 years in Hawaii. So now I say to him, when he, and so finally, so he did this. He called me on a payphone, and Ron knows that story because it's in his fourth step. He calls me on a payphone and he says, let's get married. And I said, no, I followed you around all this time. And he said, but you can come and live in Hawaii. And I said, okay, I'll get married. Kind of a joke now, but it's kind of truth too. I said, I'd have never married you if I hadn't gotten to go to Hawaii. And I loved Hawaii. And it's kind of true, because what do you know at that age? 21, and you know, what do you know? And so we went to Hawaii. We were there for 3 years, and I loved it. I loved it. Oh, I'd still be there. But I got pregnant. And he got scared, and he said, we're going, and he got a teaching job there, but he said, nope, we're going to go home, we're going to get a Sears charge card and a washer and dryer to wash those diapers, and there she is, 42. So we came home, we started the routine, and we did our thing, and right away, we wanted that stuff, the white picket fence in the house and all that stuff. The second car is what I really wanted. And so I went to work. And I really hadn't done much drinking. I forgot to tell you that when I went to Arizona State the first time, he said, now don't smoke cigarettes and don't drink coffee. That's what girls do. You know, as soon as they get there, I don't know why you're opposed to coffee, but he forgot to tell me don't drink beer. And that's when my alcoholism took off. So as you see, it's his fault. And it really and truly continued to be his fault for a lot of years. So to get that first job, it was arranged that I was going to have this job interview, and I was very nervous and scared, and I went over to the job interview in Arcadia. We lived in La Cunada. And the boss took me and the bookkeeper and one of the other employees out to lunch on the interview, and he ordered a martini. And at that time of my life, I'd only had Spignata wine and beer with him, but he usually drank more beer than I. And so I really hadn't been doing a lot of drinking yet. I was pregnant with two babies and had those, and you know, I hadn't done much drinking, but the boss ordered a martini.
Yeah.
And I didn't even know what a martini was, but I wanted that job, so I said, I'll have one too. And seven martinis later, I got the job. And I don't know how I got home that day, but I knew I had the job. And I went to work the very next day, and on a daily basis, we went to lunch. And on a daily basis, we went out after work to have a glass of wine and discuss the day's jobs, you know, the work. And my alcoholism just started. And what happened in the pattern of my life, and I'm going to zoom through, is that I found my work to be very exciting and fun, and him to be very boring. And, you know, and what happened too was I found I was real busy, energetic alcoholic. Okay. And so, you know, I would get up and fix the kids' breakfast in the morning, and I would pack their lunches, help them with their homework, and I'd always start dinner just in case I was going to get to go for a glass of wine after work, and I could call home and say the dinner's there, you know. And he was putting up with all this because I was bringing home a good paycheck at the time, and it was helping out in that way. And I stayed real busy. I was a real busy alcoholic. I was Brownie leader, and I was Cub Scout leader, and I did the school carnival. I was drunk at those things, but I did them, and I did them. And I was busy, and I didn't have to be around him, and he didn't notice. But he did notice. There were times I was just laid out on the kitchen floor, and he'd say, "This is what always astounded me." He'd say, "You've been drinking, haven't you?" And that was a broken record in our house. And I'd say, "Oh no." If he had to ask, Kent must have gotten away with it. You know, it must be. And so anyway, I don't know what time when this all happened, but at some point we did. You know, I tried to be a good wife, and we separated. I don't remember which. We did. We separated, and I'd been to some treatment centers, and it didn't work for me. They're wonderful because you get a good education. I just wasn't done. I had a lot of fear. I had a lot of shame. I had a lot of blame for myself. I had a lot of guilt. It was the hardest thing I ever did was to stay sober. It was the hardest thing I ever did to get sober, to kick that addiction. And so I did 5 treatment centers. And one time I said, "You know, it's taken 5 treatment centers to get you to Al-Anon. That must be why I keep going to treatment centers." And he believed a lot of my stuff. One of those treatment centers, I came home and I got drunk, and he called my sponsor. And he said, "She's drinking again." And so I called his sponsor, and the other brother said, "He's calling my sponsor." Yeah, that's not the way it was supposed to work. And, you know, I had a little shop up here, and I was still drinking, and I would hide it. Oh, man, I could hide everything. And I hid it, and one day I'm getting off work, and I go up in the back, and I see this little red Jeep. He had this little red Jeep when they first came out with no doors and no top and spinning around town. I could always spot him. He was supposed to be following me, but I'd spot him. And so I found him up behind my work, behind the dumpster, way up there, sitting there watching me leave work. So next day, I parked my car up around the corner and drank my booze and watched him watching me looking for me. Just the merry-go-round of our disease that we got on. Okay, so fast forward, we eventually did separate, and my mother, because I'd been raised with these secrets, I never told my mother that Pat had left, and she was coming up to see her grandchildren, and I drank till she got to my front door, and I don't know why that day, and he was gone, and how all the furniture he took too. And so I'm in this house, and I had this little sobriety dog that, when I was struggling and trying so hard to get sober, my sponsor would say, "Walk the dog and call me back." And I'd walk my dog and call her back, you know. Always those were her first words, "Walk the dog." And So I would come home at night and Magnum would just bark his head off if another car door slammed or if he heard any noise. And that made me crazy because Pat was gone, the furniture was gone, the house was huge, it echoed, it was... I had that paranoia that addicts and others have. I was full of paranoia. So I would give Magnum a little saucer of vodka every night. And he would pass out, and I could drink like a lady in my empty house. Because he was gone and everything else. So finally my mother knocks on that door one day to come see the grandchildren. I hadn't told her any of this. And I, for some reason, did not drink that weekend from Saturday until Sunday night. That's not a long time, but for this alcoholic, that was a long time, from Saturday noon until Sunday night. And I was shaken so bad, and I'd been shaken for a couple of years, but I thought I just shook because of him, you know? And I was just shaking like crazy. I called my sponsor, I said, I can't go to the Sunday night meeting. She said, you have to go. Have a bubble bath and get to the meeting. I took the bubble bath, I called her back, I said, I just can't make it, I'm shaking too bad. She said, eat some chocolate, go to the meeting. My mother literally fed me a box of See's candy to get me to stop shaking. And I went to the meeting. Well, shook and shook and shook, Dunsmore Clubhouse, and they had those theater seats at the time. And I sat in the very back row with two very old timers, old like us now. And he held me down in that seat, and in the middle of the meeting, on the hardwood, whatever floor, tile floor, I had a grand mal seizure, which is an alcohol withdrawal seizure. And that speaker that night, because we didn't have pay phones or cell phones or any of that, the speaker that night was a medical doctor. I still have that card in my wallet, and he knew what to do and what was happening, because I was like a, they said, I was like a fish out of water. And nobody knew what, I mean, I guess I'd heard about an alcohol withdrawal seizure. I don't know, but I didn't know about it. And enough to scare me to not. And so that's what happened. And so an ambulance came, took me to Verdugo, and they called him. And as I recall, he peeked through the curtain and said, yeah, that's her. Goodbye. And they transferred me down to Long Beach. And I was in a coma for 3 days. And they sent me down there, and because that's where our insurance sent me. And when I was out 3 days later, I came to, and I came out of that coma, and I was clenching, I was kind of drifting in and out, and I had all those AA cliches coming to me, like, just for today, easy does it. And I was done. I was done. But, you know, I had sat in meetings for a few years, five treatments worth, a lot of time, raising my hand again as a newcomer, newcomer, newcomer. I kept trying, and I was done that time. I just knew it inside and out. I was done. And because I really think I had the desire to quit drinking before that happened. You know, I really think I had that desire. I went to meetings with my little Donna friend here. We went to convention. I drank down there and on the way and drove down there with four ladies. I mean, I tried this stuff, you know. But I was done that day, and so I wasn't gonna call, and the nurse comes in and says, you gotta go now, and how are you gonna get home? I don't know, I wasn't gonna call him. And so I called my sister, and she said, I'm done with you. She said, I'm tired of watching you killing your children, our mother, and yourself, and I'm done. And she had no Al-Anon, she had no, you know, and I hung up with her, and the nurse said, well, now what are you going to do? I said, well, I'm not calling him. And so she said, we can call a taxi. So we got the phone book out and found a taxi, and he came. And because I learned in treatment center to share everything, tell him my whole guts. I told him I'm an alcoholic, and I'm 3 hours sober. And he pulled over on the side of the Long Beach freeway, and he said, pay up right now. He said, I've been driving drunks around my whole life. And he said, they have no money, and they tell stories. So pay up right now. And I had no money, and so the good alcoholic that can talk talked him into going to a grocery store. I had no credit cards at that time, because he took them all. And I had a Ralph's card, and he took me to a grocery store, and I, but he got out with me, and he went to the grocery store with me, and he said, "Don't go over there, that's the wine and the beer, go right here." And you know, it was years later, I said, "I got an Alan Hart taxi driver." So I got home, and my precious daughter was at the front door when I got there, and the look on her face was just to kill. I was like, "What are you doing here, Mom?" She was angry and scared and all those things. And I said, "I'm home, I'm going to a meeting." And I just jumped in the car and went to a meeting that I knew. I knew where every meeting in La Cañada was. I'd been doing it. And when I raised my hand that time as a newcomer, I felt different. I was done. And I didn't have to convince him, my sister, my kids, anybody anymore, because I'd been saying I was done when I wasn't done, you know? And I knew I was finally done. And I have embraced Alcoholics Anonymous ever since. I love our big book. I've studied our big book. And I, most importantly, I believe our big book. And it's always got the answers for me, always. And I've been very, very active in Alcoholics Anonymous my entire time, and I'm so very, very grateful. I can truly say today that I'm so grateful for each and every one of you in here that have helped him embrace the Al-Anon program, because he is today more enthusiastic and more eager and more willing than I am at times. I'm getting older and isolating a little where we live. It's not perfect out there. I don't have my home groups. I don't have what I'd like in my recovery, but I make it work with what I have. And that's real important to me. And for many years, I've been very, very involved in a women's conference that's the board that runs this conference of 350 women. There's 6 Al-Anons and 6 alcoholics that put this together. And I've always, always been attracted to the Al-Anon women that have a good recovery program. One of the first things that Pat and I ever got involved in, and that was because we said we got sentenced to the Family Afterwards Chapter 9 meeting that used to happen at Verdugo Hospital. We got sentenced there. And there was back in those days where we met Willie and Melody, there was 100 people at that meeting. And the reason I know that is because he eventually was treasurer, and we counted 100 dollar bills every night when you only put a dollar. You know, there was a big crowd back then, and Pat would sit there and I would sit there. And in the beginning, Willie and Melody remember, and if he was on the elevator, I took the stairs. And it took some time for us to get back together. And when I was first sober, we were still separated. And you know, that's when I knew nothing mattered more to me than my sobriety. And it's still that way today. It's still the most important thing I have. So I was starting to tell you that I was always attracted to the Al-Anon. I was scared of all the Al-Anon women at Chapter 9 back that far back. I was scared of them. Intimidated, uncomfortable. But as time went by and I was on this board with these other women, I was always attracted to them. And so I started visiting Al-Anon with their nudging. And I visited Al-Anon for quite a while. And I know today how much I needed and have needed and wanted Al-Anon. It was hard for me to get into the Al-Anon program. I was so rock solid in my AA. And when I first got sober, I heard from an old-timer, a lot of you probably remember Don, that would tell us to be gentle with ourselves. He would tell me when I would whine and cry, and I whined and cried a lot for many years, and I was worried about our kids and all that, and he'd say, "You know what? Recovery's contagious." He said, "You and Pat are starting to recover now, and they're hearing how you're sharing, they're hearing how you're feeling, your life's changing with recovery, and they're getting it." And so he would tell me, alcoholism's not contagious, but recovery is. And so for a lot of years I went by with, well, Al-Anon's contagious, I got it at home with him, you know. And I just visited Al-Anon for the longest time. Being raised with an alcoholic father, having it in my family. I have a sibling. You know, I just didn't quite need it yet. And then we moved out there, and I was not as connected with my roots of AA. And we go to a wonderful couples meeting, and it's a fabulous meeting. And a lot of the Al-Anon women there kept saying, you know, you could come to our meeting sometime. And they could just see it in me. And so about 2 years ago, I went back on, because we summer in Utah and winter in Havasu, and I said, all right, I need help, you know. And I found an Al-Anon sponsor, and I went to the Al-Anon meetings, and I was really not too much enjoying it a bit initially, and then I was doing it, and then I was whining, it's hard, it's really hard. And so finally she got me to come to her kitchen table. Every Wednesday we go to a meeting, then I go back to her house and go to the kitchen table, and we work those out on steps. And they're different, you know, and so I think people like my buddy Gloria there and others will say they're finally seeing me growing a little more now and getting a little better in Al-Anon. But that's new for me. And I know that both programs have the same 12 steps and the same, you know, as Pat says, recovery is recovery, but I am getting a new and different twist on it. So I don't quite yet call myself an alcoholic Al-Anon. But I am going to the meetings, and I'm on starting my fourth step. So maybe in the future I can come back and do it wholeheartedly. Pat and I have had a move, as you all know, we left. And he's been a lot happier than I. He loves it out there, and I love that he loves it out there. He loves the boating and the water and all that. And then we went up to Utah, where we spend our summers, and that's strictly, we found Utah through Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, and that's because we went first to a big conference there, and that seemed to be our roots and home for the summer. And, you know, I thank God on a daily basis, as I've told you, for my Alcoholics Anonymous and for my sobriety. But I also thank him on a daily basis for the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, because I don't know where we would be without the fellowship. I'm here to tell you that I cannot stay sober by myself, and that completely explains, and I know deep down how Bill and Dr. Bob had to have each, they needed each other, and I need all of you. I can tell you wholeheartedly that I can't sponsor him, and he can't sponsor me, because we've tried, and we got back to couples. But you know, I mean that from the bottom of my heart. I know where my roots are, and I know my tools, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love Al-Anon Family Group, and I love the fellowship. So thank you all for still being here after 22 years. It's fabulous. I love it.
Thank you so much, Candy. It was amazing. I was way up in the sticks of Canada, and I told some people where I was from, and they said, do you know Pat and Candy? I said, yes, I do know them. I see them all the time. And she said, well, we go to a conference together all the time. So now, we hear this Alan Nunnick and our founder, Pat.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah,
well, I'll do that. Hi, I'm Al-Anonic Pat, and very grateful member of the Al-Anon Family Group. God, it's good to be home. God, it was 22 years ago. It's unbelievable. And I remember it was October 10th, 1991, and Candy's right. You know, we had taken this trip. In fact, I'll tell you about that later, I guess. Then I'll tell you how the meeting got started. But it, that first meeting, yeah, Willie and I were the only ones that are still left from that first meeting. That are still active members, although I'm a little inactive. But you know, everywhere I go, it doesn't matter if I'm in an Al-Anon meeting. My home group is the La Cunada Men, 7 o'clock, let's rock. And they say, well, where's that? You know? And then other people, we were at the Great Outdoor Beaver Meet, and right here. And they came to the meeting, and oh, God, it was so great. And so it's amazing how this program works. But, you know, it's hard because we live so far away now. We spend our time in Arizona and Utah, pretty much, and it's hard, you know. They don't have meetings there like they do here. And that doesn't mean they don't have good meetings, but they don't have very many of them, and they're hard to get to sometimes. You got to drive 50 miles to get to a meeting. But we have two in Beaver, and Candy and I started an Al-Anon meeting in Beaver, and it's having growing pains. I mean, it hasn't really taken off. You know, the town's only 2,000 people, and it's just such a little town, and you know how that is. Everybody knows everybody else's business, and so it's hard. It's hard to get going, but we've enjoyed that, and so we'll see what happens there. But and then, like she said, in Arizona, we go to a great couples meeting on Friday night, and there's a wonderful Al-Anon meeting on Saturday mornings, and so it's really you know, it's tough though, because we got to travel across the lake to go to the meeting, and I love that because we get to go on our boat and park the boat, and we walk up. We have a car parked on the other side, and I think it's a real adventure. You know, I like it. And Candy hasn't quite bought into it completely yet, but she's getting better. And she did get a great sponsor, and I didn't say anything, you know, but she found a great sponsor. She got 28 years in AA and 18 years in Al-Anon. And I could just see the change in her, and I loved it. And I didn't say too much, you know. I just said, wow, this is really good. And sure enough, this last summer, they sold their house and moved back to Colorado. So her sponsor now is in Colorado. But she's a real trooper. She loves the program, either one, both of them. Because she knows it saved our life, saved our marriage. And so we'll forever be grateful for that. But she's right, you know, I say I'm an Al-Anonic, and most of the guys in here know why that is. And I'm an Al-Anon with alcoholic tendencies. Now, I'm not an alcoholic. You know, I started out, they told me you need to find out all you can about alcoholism. For me, that's the best place is the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know Jack C. is real big in that. And so that's where I found out that alcoholism is a twofold disease. It's an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. Today I know I don't have that allergy, but I definitely have the obsession of the mind. I am a real thinker, analyzer. I thought I had the power to get my wife sober. I just give me enough time, and I'll figure it out. And I tried for 10 years, and I'm here to tell you, I went one-on-one with alcoholism, and I lost. And it took me a long time to surrender to that. And I'll tell you in the story how that happened, but it's just amazing. And, you know, I remember early on, Candy had trouble getting sober, you know, and she came home, she had a new sponsor, and she was real excited. She said, man, my new sponsor says I need to go to 99 AA meetings in 90 days and don't drink between meetings. And I said, God, that sounds great to me. Well, I went to my Monday night men's group. I started out at San Marino men's group, and I went there, and I had a guy that I was thinking about asking to be my sponsor, and we went out to the meeting on Monday night, and after the meeting, we went out for coffee, and I told him, I said, hey, Don, I said, Candy's got a new sponsor, and she told her that she needs to go to 99 AA meetings in 90 days and don't drink between meetings. And God, he just shakes his head. And he looks at me and he says, Pat, he said, you need to go to 90 Al-Anon meetings in 90 days and don't think between meetings. That pretty much sums up, you know, my committee's up there, and it was taking a lot of space in my head, boy. I couldn't get, you know, it was just a mess. I was a mess. And so, you know, but she's right. We met for the first time at 14. She had a skateboard. There was a 2x4 with roller skates. So that's what it was when I was a kid. And she loosened it, you know. These her girlfriends, it was right 3 weeks before high school. And so her girlfriends, oh, you got to have a boyfriend. And so they all schemed it up. And she made it fall off right in front of my house in the ivy. She came up and knocked on my door. You know, I give her credit, you know, because I didn't know her. And she knocked on the door, and she opens the door, and she says, "Hi, I'm Candy." And I didn't know I was going to be hearing that for the rest of my life. She didn't say alcoholic, but "Hi, I'm Candy." And so I took it back to my garage, in my dad's garage, and I fixed it. And I said to myself, "Oh, she's pretty cute, you know." But that was, and then we started school a few weeks later. And damn, you know, I was going to ask her out, and she had hooked up with one of my best friends. And I go, "Oh, brother," you know. So they were dating for a while, and in fact, a year and a half. And, and I thought I was doomed. But finally, one of my other best friends saw me right before summer break, and he says, "Hey, you hear Jim and Candy broke up?" I said, "No way." And he said, "Yeah." I said, "Oh man, I gotta get a shot now, you know." Well, a few weeks later, she was working down Laguna Beach at the Laguna Beach Art Festival. And so she and another friend were down there. And so the guy I played football with we got jumped in the car and went down one day to see him. And I'll never forget it, you know, because that was the first time she remembered, she said, when I fixed her skateboard. But when I really took notice for her, we walked down on the beach, and I still remember this day. She had a turquoise bikini on, and she spread out her towel to, you know, and she bent over to do that. And I go, "Oh my God," and I fell in lust right then. And next thing I know, you know, we go out on the first date to Disneyland, and it's all on. Took me 2 months of grass cutting money to get to afford to do that. But that's funny. It's just, and you know, it's one of those things, stereotypical things. She was the head cheerleader, and I was on the football team, and but it was, we kind of had our problems, and like she said, she went to Arizona State, and I chickened out. I didn't think I was good enough. That's how I relate to alcoholics. I never think I'm good enough. You know, I'm just not good enough, and so I instead of going there, I ended up at San Jose State on a one-year scholarship, and sure enough, the very first game of the season, we're playing Cal up there at their stadium up there, and I was at San Jose State, and third play, I was pulling around on in sweep, and I got submarined right in my right knee, and it just tore it up, and the doctor said I probably couldn't play anymore, and I knew better, and I got recruited by the University of Hawaii and went over there, and just, it was the greatest thing that ever happened to me, so it all turned out right. But she's right, I called her on that phone. I couldn't afford to fly home and propose to her. And Ron, my sponsor, knows this story. I illegally, because I didn't have any money. I got these two phones that were together. I'll make it real fast. And I put money in one phone, but I talked in the other. Because back then, they didn't have computers or anything. And all they wanted to do was hear the ding, ding, ding when you put the quarters in. Well, shoot, it was $8.75 for 3 minutes. So I'm sitting in this. So I took the receiver off of one, and I talked to the other, and I'm using the other phone that doesn't work. But she can hear, and I go like this, and she can hear it go ding, ding, ding. Finally, I said, "Okay, that's enough." So I talked for 3 minutes, and then it all was over. So I hung up the phone, and all the money dropped down. Did it again, and she tried. She wasn't easy on me. I mean, she didn't want to get married, but then she realized, wait a minute, he's over there in Hawaii, and he's going to be there for 3 years. So I said, "Well, we get to live over for 3 years." And boy, she changed her tune real fast. And she loves it there. She wished we could still live there. But anyway, that's how it all started. And it's so baffling to me because she really, you know, there was really no active alcoholism. She would have a glass of wine, but that's it, like a normie, you know. And I drank far more than she did in the beginning. Our biggest thing, we'd go out to Lackawanna Beach on a Saturday night and barbecue hot dogs and beans and drink a six-pack of Primo beer. And Primo beer is Hawaiian beer. And back then, it was the cheapest beer you could buy. It was 99 cents a six-pack. And I'd have four or five, and she'd have one or two. That's the way it was, you know. And but boy, did that change. And like she said, we came back, and we wanted that American dream, you know, an extra car and a boat, and we got those things. So she went back to work. She made more money than me. It didn't bother me. A lot of men were threatened back then that their wife would make more money than they did. Shoot, she gave me the paycheck. So I bought a boat, and we bought a place out at the river, and boy, we'll talk about a good place to drink. That was a mistake there. But that's what we do. We go out there and drink. And I'd buy a couple of cases of beer and put them in the boat, and we'd go up to the sandbar and we'd drink. And we came home, I remember this one particular time, and I stopped in the afternoon, you know. I'm here to tell you, I'm a weak stick. I can't keep up with you guys, you alcoholics that are in this room. And so I slowed down. And she just kept going, and we went to bed that night and woke up the next morning together at the same time. And I looked at her, and her eyes were all bloodshot, and she was just, I could tell she was miserable. And I felt pretty good, because I had quit in the afternoon and got a good night's sleep. And so I looked at her, I said, gee, honey, I said, how can you keep doing this to yourself? And she says, you know, I don't know, I just don't think I can stop. Wow, she said that. It dawned on me. Oh my God, my wife might be an alcoholic. I said, you know, that fleeting thought lasted for about 2 seconds, because the next thing that went on in my mind was, oh good, now I know what the problem is, now I can fix it. Well, you know what that was like. And for the next 10 years, I tried to fix it, and I tried everything. I pleaded with her, I cried, I told her, you know, everything you can think of that we do. And I was a mean guy too, but that, you know, I was so angry about that, and I just was rageful. That's how my dad was, and I never was physical, but I was certainly verbally abusive, I'm sure. And I'd yell at her and scream at her and get in her face, and of course, the more I did that, the more she drank. And finally, found out a counselor told someone, well, she's drinking at you, and so. That time came when I, you know, Al-Anon says, don't make any threats you don't intend to carry out. I was going nuts. Our kids would tell you that I was a crazy one. You know, I'd come home yelling and screaming, you know, and kicking the dog and all that kind of stuff, and yell and screaming, and it wasn't working. It just wasn't working. So I went to her and I said, look, something's got to give here. You know, either you're going to have to move out or I'm going to have to move out. Well, guess who was the one driving down the street today? It was me, because she wasn't going to move out. So I got an apartment. We sold that place at the river so I could afford to do that. But I was paying the mortgage and paying rent for 7 months. And during that time, you know, I'd hear little things like, oh, gee, dear Candy, got 30 days, you know. And I said, well, big deal. She got 30 days in 5 different treatment centers. So what? And then she got 60 days, and then she got 90 days. And I started scratching my head. And all of a sudden, I woke up one day, and she had 6 months. That's what they were telling me. And I couldn't believe it. And I was pissed. I said, how can AA get her sober? I couldn't get her sober, you know. And I didn't get it. I didn't get it. And so finally, I told her I have to move back in to the house because I can't, you know, all the money's gone that we sold for the river place. And I was real genuine about it. You know, I said, I know this might upset you. And we both had counselors at that time. And she says, okay, well, you know, let's go talk to our counselors. And our insurance plan had this thing. And so we went to talk to each of them. They got together. And then they said, well, we might try it. Maybe we'll try it. And just with little baby steps. And that's what it was. I felt like I was that 15-year-old kid again, starting out dating again, you know. And but this time, you know, we just became friends. We did it the right way, you know. And it started to work a little bit. And I remember that one counselor, he was a strict son of a gun. He told me, he actually gave me what amounted to a court card. I said, no, well, I'm an Al-Anon. I'm not an alcoholic. He said, I don't care. I want you to go to 30 meetings, and I want you to have them signed by the secretary of that meeting. And Gloria, where are you? Gloria was the secretary over here. Gloria was the secretary of a meeting in Pasadena, and I went in there and sat down. And I'd been going to Al-Anon, you know, by then. But, you know, I was just kind of like around the fringes. You know, I hadn't dove into the program and done the steps and everything. But I went to that meeting, and after the meeting, I went up to her, and I said, oh, hi, Gloria, can you sign this for me? And she looks at me, and she says, no, no, no. She said, the Al-Anon meeting's down the hall over here in the other building. And I mean, the AA meeting. And I said, well, I'm not an AA. She said, well, what are you doing here? She said, well, I don't know. My counselor said I had to do it. Would you please sign it? She laughed, and she finally signed it. And so that's kind of how it started when we started getting back together. And it was a little baby steps. We didn't know if it was going to work. She was scared to death. But we did that, and things started to turn around. And you know, she had that time where she had that grand mal seizure. And thank God that apparently was her bottom, and she finally was able to turn it around. And she'll tell you this day, she didn't say it tonight, but she was struck sober. You know, God intervened some way, and she had that spiritual awakening, and it finally worked. I had given up. I thought I was looking down a barrel of a divorce. I thought, here we're high school sweethearts, and never going to, you know, be together forever, and that wasn't going to happen. It didn't look like. But, you know, it didn't have to happen because of Al-Anon and AA. Sorry, I get emotional about that. So we started back again, it's just miraculous how it happens. I was probably in Al-Anon for 2.5 years when I really had my honest to goodness first spiritual awakening. In fact, we were together then, I think, and we had went to this meeting, and it was a priest, Father Leo, I think. And he was doing a talk. He was an AA and Al-Anon both. And he was doing a talk on the difference between spirituality and religion. Now, I grew up in a very strict religion. You know, a lot of people say they're recovering Catholic and all that. But that I believe that God was a punishing God. That was my perception. If you miss church on Sunday, you're going to hell and all that stuff. And I believed it. So I figured I was doomed anyway. And I had to learn to relearn that stuff, those tapes in my head about the punishing God, and find a God of my understanding, a higher power of my understanding. And he explained very clearly the difference between spirituality and religion. He says, they certainly can coexist. People are spiritual people and are religious, but they're not the same thing. And the light went on, you know. And I says, wow. So, you know, it's that's the way it is. I can find a God of my understanding. And that was my first spiritual awakening. And what happened was, I woke up one day and I just realized that I was going to be okay. Maybe we were going to get divorced. But you know what? I was going to be okay. God was going to take care of me. And God was going to take care of Candy. It was going to be the way it was supposed to be, and I believe that. I was going to be okay. Right, Dublin?
Yes.
Okay. Dublin and I had a nice long talk one time about that. And so that's how it started. I finally surrendered, totally surrendered. And I remember we went to a conference one with Marcia, and the slogan was that, remember what it was? Surrender to win. And I thought that was the stupidest thing I'd ever seen. You know, my dad said, you never give up. You fight the good fight. You know, right is might. You stick to your guns, and boy, I hung on to that too long. And so surrender to win didn't make any sense to me, but finally it kicked in, you know. Finally it kicked in. Just like the first Al-Anon speaker I ever heard. She got up there and said, I'm so grateful to be married to an alcoholic. And I thought, oh God, I wanted to puke. And I almost got up and walked out. Today I get it. Today I get it. I am proud to be married to an alcoholic. I wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be married today. And so I'm forever grateful for that. So it started to progress, and we did finally move back in, and we started to do things together, and we went to, and then we had these counselors, and her sponsor said, hey, you got to go to this chapter 9 meeting, couples, and she's right. We did, and that's where we met Willie and Melody, and so we went there, but I was over in one side of the room, and she was the other. So it took a while for us to get, you know, get together on it. But finally we did. It did just little baby steps. And God, I think Candy became secretary and I was treasurer. And oh boy, we're the happy AA Al-Anon couple, you know. But we took it seriously. And actually we went on a sober vacation. And that was a couple before I talked you into going, Jack. And then we had some friends. Well, we met these friends at the airport. And I'm telling you, it was a God shot. This couple was in line, and Candy and I were in line. And I said, hey, this gal behind you, has the same kind of clothes you do. She wears real colorful clothes, and this gal had real colorful clothes. And I said, why don't you say something? And so this, and this lady actually, her name was Debbie, and we're one of our best friends, Debbie and Chuck. And she said, yeah, where are you going? I said, well, we're going on this vacation to Mexico. Well, where about? And it was Sonora Bay. And of course, Sonora Bay was a Club Med, and it was all sober vacation people. And they were going the same place. And boy, they just latched onto us. And on the airplane, we got to sit next to them, and everything was, you know, just, geez, just pumping candy about stuff. Candy was probably 7 months sober. And then five? Okay, 5 months sober. So I always like to give you more credit, honey. And, so, and then what amazed me was Chuck, and he was also an alcoholic, Debbie's husband, and he got, they got done talking, chatting, and then he looks over at me and says, well, Pat, I want to hear your story. And I said, what? You want to hear? I'm just an Al-Anon. What are you doing here? And he said, no, I want to hear your story. I want to hear your side of things. And boy, we just got along with them. And when we got back, they sentenced us to go to not only Chapter 9, but also two couples retreats that they did a year. One in San Juan Capistrano, the Valentine's Retreat, and then the other ones in Lake Arrowhead. And we still do those to this day. And that really was helpful for our relationship. I mean, we both had, you know, our foundation and our own programs. But when we got to the couples things, we kind of blended our recovery a little bit. And you know what we learned? We learned how to communicate. You know, not like I used to communicate. You know, all of a sudden they had this thing called listening. You know, I thought I was a great communicator. I tell Candy what to do, and she told you she gave me the power. I told her what to do, and she'd do it, and I said, I'm a great communicator. And, so I learned this thing about how to listen. And another big thing was, you know what? It wasn't so important because I had this need to be right. Oh, my God, I had this need to be right. Because that was my self-worth. If I wasn't right, then I was nothing. And so I learned that it was okay. And then one day, another awakening. You know, I think I'm right. She thinks she's right. But I have to be right. But you know what? Maybe we're both right. Maybe it's just two different perspectives, you know. And so we both could be right. And wow, then I finally said, well, it's not so important, you know. I mean, I still like to be right, but it's not so important. I mean, I will let it go. You know, the people that always say, well, you'd rather be right or rather be happy. Of course, I want both. But, you know, it's not so important anymore. And I let in a lot easier because I know. I know, you know. And what happened was I started to have compassion after I had that first spiritual awakening, because I knew Candy really wanted to get sober, and I knew it was just eating her alive. And so I started to have compassion for her. Well, that's when you're in trouble, when you realize you got to have compassion and you're an Al-Anon. But that's what happened. And so I started to just look at things differently. See, because the problem was, plain and simple, I thought alcoholism was a moral issue. You know, and how many times did I tell her, if you really love me, if you honestly love me, you would quit drinking? And she wanted to quit drinking, but she couldn't. And I'd always ask her, why do you do this to yourself? Why do you keep doing this when you know what's going to happen? You know? And finally, somebody told me, you know, why did she drink? Because she's an alcoholic. And that's all I need to know. You know, because I thought if she could tell me why, I could fix it. Which I never could have, but you know, that's what I thought. Oh, she can just tell me what's wrong. The first Al-Anon meeting I went to, it was right after the family thing at the treatment center. And I went in this room, actually to the treatment center first, and we did this around the circle family thing, and tell us your name and how you feel, you know. And I have to sit right next to the counselor, and I had to go first. So I didn't get the benefit of knowing what everybody else was going to share about. So how was I sitting in the chair, Jack? Like this, you know. And they said, okay, sir, just tell us your name and how you feel. And I said, my name's Pat, and I feel fine. And that's all I said. That's all I said. And I could hear some people snickering because they knew what was coming. And this counselor ripped me up one side, down the other. And you could see the smoke coming out of my ears. And I said, whoa. You know, and I don't know what went on too much after that, because I was seething, you know. But what did happen was, this gal came up to me after the meeting, and she ended up, she was my Eskimo. She said, "Hey, Pat," and you know, it was a godsend, because if it had been a guy, you know, came up to me and said, "Hey, you dummy, don't you know about Al-Anon? You got to get your butt to Al-Anon." I'd have told him where to go and how fast, you know. And it wasn't. It was this nice young lady, and she came up to me. She said, "Hi, Pat, I'm, what? Sylvia. Thank you. I'm Sylvia." And I said, "Yeah, what can I do for you?" She said, "Well, you know, have you ever heard of Al-Anon?" And I said, "No, I don't think so." She said, "Well, you know, there's a meeting here tonight at 7 o'clock, an Al-Anon meeting, and you might be interested in that, you know?" And my first question was, "Will help my wife get sober?" And she kind of said, "Well, I don't know. You never know." And so I said, "Well, if it'll help Candy get sober, I'll go." So I went that night, and I walked in, and of course, you know what I saw. Everyone in there, about a dozen of them, and they're all women. I was the only guy. And I started to turn around. I said, "This isn't for me." Started to turn around, and the secretary walked in. She went and got a drink and came back, and she closed the door. I said, "Well, hi, you're a newcomer?" You know, duh. And so I said, "Have a seat." So I sat down. And I can't tell you what happened at that meeting, except that at the end they said, "Well, let's hear from Pat, our newcomer." And I heard all those people share. I didn't quite listen to what they were saying, but they were spilling their guts. So I said, "Oh, yeah, well, listen, I see you have these steps and the traditions up here. Just tell me which one I have to work to get my wife sober. I'll do them all if you want me to, if it helps my wife get sober." And this little old lady, you know, typical, stereotypical lady in the back. Back then they had blue hair. I don't see that much anymore. But she was an old lady, just about the same age I am now. She says those three words, you know, that I didn't want to hear. And you all know what it is. "Keep coming back." Because I didn't get it. I didn't get it. It took me a long time to get it. Yeah, they hit me over the head with a 2x4 to get my attention into it. And I just didn't get it. But finally, the light came on. You know, we call it the aha in here. And I wanted to say, you know, the biggest thing, the most spiritual thing for me that I love in Al-Anon meetings, or any meeting, AA too, is the laughter. You know, there's healing power in laughter. And we're doing it tonight. And newcomers, if you hear, you like, you know, some newcomers, and they're really hurt. And we have to watch out for that. Because they come in and they're in a divorce situation or maybe violence or whatever. And it's a serious thing for them, and I understand that. But, you know, when you can, you know, when they stick around long enough to let the miracle happen for them, and then they kind of get the idea and they loosen up a little bit and they start focusing on them, they realize it's going to be okay. And all of a sudden, one night you see them, they smile, and then they're laughing. Boy, like Cliff Roach used to say, that's when you know you got them. You know, when we can get them laughing, and they keep coming back, and things start to get better in their life. And that's the way it's been for me. That's been my experience. And like I say, you know, last month, Candy and I celebrated 46 years of marriage. And you know, I don't know how we got from there to here. But I can tell you this, we have more years in recovery now in our marriage than not. So that's a great thing. And I'm sure, you know, we're looking forward to more. And that's how it works. But, you know, I don't know how much time I got. I'll tell real quick about the meeting that started. You know, Candy said, we went on this trip, and we were coming back to Palm Springs, and we went to Betty Ford Center, and I went to an Al-Anon meeting, she went to an AA meeting. We met this guy that was in an Al-Anon for a long time. And he said, "Hey, why don't you come tomorrow night to my men's Al-Anon?" And then that kind of planted the seed. And I said, "Well, we can't. We have to get home. But thank you anyway." And on the way home, I was whining. You know, I got to go to the San Marino men's group, and it starts at 8:30. And it's not over till 10. And then we go after the meeting. I get home at midnight, and I got to get up and teach a class at 7 o'clock in the morning. And I'm getting tired of it. So really, it was a resentment. That's, you know. And Candy says, "Oh, quit your whining. Why don't you just start a men's group in La Cañada?" Well, maybe that might not be a bad idea. And so I called central office, and they gave me some stuff and some phone numbers. I had to call the World Service office in New York, and we got signed up and everything. And first thing I did was go to the Friday night, or it was a Saturday night, chapter 9. I can't remember which night it was. I think it was Saturday night. And the first thing I did, I saw Willie. I said, "Hey, Willie, I'm going to start this men's Al-Anon meeting. can you help me? Want to be a part of it? And he says, yeah, I'll be there. That's when it was, October 10th, 1991, we had that first meeting. And I had about 12 guys there. But Willie and I were the only ones from that stayed in the group. And well, the others were all the guys from my Monday night San Marino's group. I asked them and told them, I'm starting a meeting. Would you help support it for the first few weeks, you know? And they were really great about it, and they did. So that's what happened. So we got that meeting going. I remember Willie and I, and then third or fourth meeting, Jack H. came, and then Ron, my sponsor, and then Jack. We met Jack and Leslie at a San Fernando Valley Convention in February, I think. So the meeting started in October, and they were sitting at our table at the Al-Anon luncheon. I was telling them, yeah, I'm starting this men's, I started this men's group. Men's Al-Anon, really, really? And I said, okay, well, give me the address, and where is it, and what time is it? And, you know, enthusiastic Jack can get. Boy, sure enough, that next week there he was, and we just kept doing that first year. You know, it didn't grow a whole lot, but you know, how did this happen? You know, all of a sudden, 22 years later, and it's just a bigger group. I can't believe it, I didn't do anything. I planted the seed. That's all. You guys made it grow, and that's the most powerful thing for me, is to see the recovery that's transpired in this room over the years. You know, it's not just the numbers, it's the recovery. It's the recovery that happens, and to see what happens, and to see people change, it's just remarkable. So it's been really great to see that. And then the other thing is, we started two retreats. You know, the first one we did, we signed up in San Lorenzo in November. And of course, it took off and it got big. So then we had to start another one. So San Marino had a men's group up there. And they, for whatever reason, they were starting to dwindle. And they were up there one weekend and they had like four guys show up for the thing. Were you there, Roger? Okay. Well, yeah, you and I think Scott. You know, Scott. So they called me up and they said, hey, because we were talking, we got to get another week, you know, up here. And they said, well, the San Marino men's group are going to give up this one in May. And would you like to have it? He said, are you kidding me? And we jumped all over it. And then we got that started. So we've been having our two retreats every year for probably, I think it's been at least 12 or 15 years. I think it was 1996 was our first one. But then the second one was just, about maybe 8 years ago or something like that. But God, what a blessing. You know, God took care of us. It was just a God shot all the way. So it's just amazing how that has transpired. And then, of course, the name of the group, and many of you have heard this, but Willie was at a world service, you know. Were you in Hawaii that time? Yeah. Okay. Well, he came back, and he was all jazzed, boy. He said, hey, Pat, he said, we got to come up with a name for our group. You know, back then, they let you put the name in the directory. They don't do it anymore, right? And so you could put your name in there, whatever you wanted, almost. And so we said, Willie, you must have a name. You got a good name. He said, yeah, I got a good one. He said, what's that? He says, why don't we call it the La Cañada Men's Kick-Ass Group? And we said, well, Willie, yeah, maybe, but I don't know if Central Office will go for that. They're not going to print that. And so we thought for about a month or two and trying to think of a name, you know. And, you know, I love music, and I heard an Elton John song, you know, it's called Saturday Night's All Right for Fighting. And some of the lyrics are, it's 7 o'clock and I want to rock, I want to get a belly full of beer. My old man's drunker than a barrel full of monkeys, and my old lady, she don't care. And I said, if that's not a song about alcoholism, I don't know what it is. And, you know, I started the meeting at 7 o'clock. Because I wanted to, you know, and all the guys complained, oh, it's too early. I got to get home from work at 5:30 and I got to have dinner and then race over to the meeting. It's just, can't we change it to 8 o'clock? And, you know, that's what San Marino's was, 8:30. I said, nope, it's 7 o'clock. Because I was a school teacher and I got out of 3, so I didn't care. You know? I'm sure glad you haven't changed it, because then we'd have to change the name. But that's how we got 7 o'clock, Let's Rock. So, anyway, gosh, it's so good to be back. Good to see you guys. For the newcomers that are here, the one thing I can offer you that I absolutely know for sure works, and that's hope. You know, there's hope here. I found that. When I came here, I was hopeless and helpless and rageful. I mean, I was sprung loaded in the pissed off position, and I didn't know why. And today, I'm not like that anymore. I'm not that rageful, angry guy that I used to be. And it's all because of the men in this room. And anyway, like I say, we're vacillating back and forth all over the country, going places, but my heart's always been here. And so the newcomers, I hope you keep coming back. And all you guys, I want you to know I love you. And let's keep on rocking, all right? Thanks.
How lucky are we?